to Regionally Speaking. I'm your host, Dee Dotson.
During his 2024 State of Higher Education Address, Commissioner Chris Lowry reflected upon higher education policy as well as programmatic successes. This year's address focused on the Commission's collaborative efforts to improve college enrollment, completion, graduation retention, and research outcomes over the past 12 to 18 months. During the address, Commissioner Lowry outlined how the Commission is addressing the challenges and opportunities facing higher education in Indiana through the HOPE agenda, Hoosier Opportunities and Possibilities Through Education. Additionally, he revisited recent legislative victories from the 2023 and the 2024 sessions and shared early indicators of those strategic initiatives. Commissioner Lowry, as you're crisscrossing the state, sharing some of the highlights from your 2024 State of Higher Education Address, I thank you for joining us here at our Lakeshore Public Media Studios.
Dee, thank you for having me here. I'm just delighted to be with you today.
Commissioner Lowry, so you're in the region today following your 2024 State of Higher Education Address. And I want to say you had a lot of good news to share with Hoosiers. I want to spend our time today going through a few of the updates as well as successes. But before we unpack a few highlights, take a moment to introduce yourself to our listening audience. And if you don't mind, include details regarding your role with the Indiana Commission for Higher Education.
Dee, thanks so much. Yes, my name is Chris Lowry, and I'm just barely 2 years into serving in this role. I have a background in higher education and in business and public policy. So, you know, this seemed like a great fit at this point in my career. I spent about 8 years with Ivy Tech Community College, actually stood up and then led their workforce side of the college there with President Sue Elsperman. Prior to that, I was in industry for 20 years, where I gained a lot of experiences, including workforce development. And prior to that, as my adult children would say, I was a policy wonk. They might just say a nerd. And so all of those things kind of come together here. But yeah, our role at the commission is to serve as the coordinating body for all of our public institutions, all seven of the public institutions and regionals and so forth, and then to work very closely with our private institutions. In fact, today I'm going to be spending some time visiting with folks in up here in the region in higher education, but also to spend time with employers. I try to make a concerted effort to spend time with employers, folks in K-12, community and faith-based organizations, and our role at the commission, my ultimate responsibilities include helping to set the strategy for higher education in Indiana, and we also have management responsibility for our state's portfolio of need-based financial aid. It's about a $400 million portfolio, and I'm sure we'll talk a little bit about it.
Absolutely. So let's get right into it. Again, in your role as the commissioner with the Indiana Commission for Higher Education, you gave an address and reflections included the 2024 Indiana legislative session, and you highlighted a few early indicators of success. And going back for just a moment, in 2023, the commission announced its HOPE agenda to position Indiana as a top 10 state by 2030. Let's go through just a few of the improvements as part of the HOPE agenda, which outlines seven goals. Starting with college enrollment, Region policymaker State Representative Earl Harris Jr. authored House Enrolled Act 1449 during the 2023 Indiana legislative session, which now auto-enrolls all 8th grade students into the 21st Century Scholars Program. Walk us through why this single piece of legislation will improve college enrollment and affordability.
You have literally hit on my favorite topic in my 2 years of having served in this role. Representative Harris, been a friend for a long time, and his leadership on this was just absolutely extraordinary. So I'll tie this together. 2 years ago, or almost 2 years ago after I arrived, we started identifying and really pointing out, frankly, with a lot of noise, that our college going rate or enrollments, especially of high school seniors, had been declining. And it had been declining for a decade, down from about 68% to 53%. And to me, and then as we started talking about it, it was very alarming to folks. You know, and when you pull those numbers apart, it was even worse, if you will, that it was even more alarming when we looked at the fact, I think at that time, the college going rate was only 43% for black students, 44% for Hispanic students, 15 point difference between young men and young women, young men being lower, right? Wow. Mm-hmm. And then for low income students, it was 30%. However, low income students who were part of the 21st Century Scholars Program, only difference being that they had been brought into the 21st Century Scholars Program, you know, through high school, their college going rate is 81%. That's amazing, right?
Phenomenal.
Yeah, phenomenal. Mm-hmm. Higher than almost any category other than a couple of really small categories of students that have completed the Indiana College Corps and things like that. Mm-hmm. So really good success. Well, Representative Harris and I talked, and then we started talking with folks, community-based organizations, faith-based organizations, policy leaders, et cetera. And as I was talking to our team, you know, I said, so tell me about where we are with 21st Century Scholars. And they said, hey, Chris, you know, it's been around for 30-some years, which I knew, but we were only getting about half the kids who are eligible enrolled.
Right.
And a child has to be enrolled by the end of their eighth grade year, which is technically June 30th of that school year. And so, you know, Representative Harris pushed this. We got, frankly, this was one of my favorite things about this, D. We had wide support from Democrats, from Republicans, from urban, from rural, from suburban. And, mm-hmm. you know, I've pointed to it several times beyond the most important thing about it, which is that a lot of kids are going to get helped now and get the opportunities that many of us have had. It also just showed to me a different spirit that we don't hear or see often enough in sort of a divisive time we have. Mm-hmm. So I'll set that aside. Maybe that's another topic for another interview someday, Dee.
Yeah.
But what we did was we made the case for it. You know, certainly there would be an increase in the expenditures, but we were only getting about half of the kids.
Right.
And the first time someone said to me, well, Chris, you know, here's what the additional expenditures will be. I said, you know, okay, that's interesting, but what you're not telling me is the rest of the equation. And so we did a return on investment analysis, and not really surprisingly, right, what we saw, very conservatively estimated, is that over the life of these extra children who would be brought into this because they already qualified, their wages, just the difference in their wages over their lifetimes, would be more than 10% of our original investment.
Wow.
And the increase in tax receipts, state and local, over that time would more than pay for the original investment, right? So this just became exactly
You know, I never considered that. That's interesting.
It was really breathtaking to us. Mm-hmm. And so, to cut to the chase, it passed. I think it was unanimous, or might have had a stray no vote here and there, maybe in a committee or something like that. But just it was widely embraced, and I think no one had really felt that, you know, we could gain momentum to do something like this. I didn't even know it had really been discussed other than just passing conversations over the years. But here's the impact. This is what has happened. So we have to enroll these children, these young people, by the time they're finished being eighth graders. In 2022, the year before this passed, we only enrolled about 20,000 students statewide. And that was less than half of the kids eligible.
Right.
In 2023, on June 30th, I literally have chills thinking about it and talking about it. Every time I do, we enrolled over 46,000 kids. So from 20,000 the previous year to over 46,000 the next year. And I mean, I literally think of this every day, because there are young people who are going to have these opportunities. You know, during high school, if people are familiar with the 21st Century Scholars Program, they get support to be good students, good citizens, expectations like filing the FAFSA, having a college and career plan, keeping a minimum GPA, you know, just, you know, keeping your nose out of trouble. You know, like I say, good citizen, good student stuff. And then the promise of this is you will receive full tuition and some other fees to go to one of our public institutions, same level of funding if you go to a private. And what's so great about it is the ability then for the students to get other additional grants and scholarships that, you know, in most instances, it pays for everything, room, board, et cetera. So it's, you know, an economist had some writing on this not long after it passed. These are his words, not mine, but I think he may be right. Mm-hmm. He referred to it as the most significant piece of economic development legislation in the state of Indiana in over 50 years.
Yes.
And you know, I agree. Human development, human capital development, it's good for the person. It's good for employers. It's good for communities in our entire state. So it truly is one of the well, it may be the best thing I've ever been involved in my now 40-year professional career.
One thing I think about regarding Hoosiers is this shift in changing careers, returning to school to level up, if you will. And one more goal from the HOPE agenda I would like to talk about is this priority for adult learners. Can you spend some time talking more about how adult learners can receive credit for prior learning?
Yeah, and I'm so glad, again, you pointed that out. And thank you for saying a few different times about the HOPE agenda. I have to say really quickly for your audience, it's an acronym. It stands for Hoosier Opportunities and Possibilities Through Education. And probably won't have time today, but there's so many documented facts that economically and socially people benefit from, you know, every increase of level of training and education, you know, from wages to unemployment to, frankly, life expectancy, infant mortality, you know, unemployment, labor participation rates, the whole nine yards. It just statistically improves with each level of training and education. So, you know, back to your question, though, about adults, we decided to place a very serious focus, along with enrollment and along with completions and then graduate retention. Two really key and interrelated areas that we decided to place focus on were getting more Hoosier adults back in the game, you know, whether they had had any training or education after a high school diploma, or even if they had some degree and then realized, oh, I need to know more about technology. That might be me as an example. I have somebody who's literally helping tutor me on AI because I don't know what I don't know. And so with this focus, we said, let's really put an emphasis on adults, including funding that's available, you know, grants and scholarships like our adult student grant, workforce ready grant, you know, and the like. But then also focus on some specific populations. We have chosen to focus on veterans and individuals in the military, those with disabilities, and the justice involved. The reality is, in each of those areas, they don't get as much attention as statistically they really need. In fact, less so than the broader adult population. And yet, the results when they receive training and education are really good. You know, vastly, they're great. You know, they're great employees, very focused, you know, want to do well, and so forth. So, coupling up to that, there has been something called credit for prior learning that's been around for a number of years, but frankly, not really leveraged, not leveraged in Indiana and only leveraged sparingly around the country. Credit for prior learning is, you know, to sort of simplify it, it is taking and quantifying what an individual has learned, what their knowledge is through any credit or through different forms of prior training or education and also work experiences. So I'll give you some examples. You know, in my instance, in 20 years in industry, we did a lot of different training, you know, including on lean manufacturing and human resources and strategy and so forth. And so that's an example where someone may have received training, you know, in their place of employment or maybe even formally, you know, a certification program, say in manufacturing, a certified production technician. And but then also through their work experiences have learned, you know, a lot of what might otherwise be captured in curriculum and in a degree. So credit for prior learning helps an institution, higher ed institution, and then the individual quantify those things and say, hey, this will count for X number of hours with the college. So I'll use the one example. I mentioned certified production technician. It's a national thing, a certification that folks can get in the manufacturing environment. I think I've got this right, that transfers directly into Ivy Tech, I believe, for 9 credit hours toward, you know, different programs. That's amazing. That's, you know, that's 3 classes that someone then would not have to take.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Right? Mm-hmm. And then, you know, I've pointed to a friend of mine who were almost the same age. In his instance, he and some relatives started a business about 40 years ago, about the time I was finishing my undergrad. He didn't go to go to traditional college. But over the years, he and his family built a business that employs about 1,500 people, about $250 million in revenue, you know, 2 or 3 states here in the U.S. They're also in Mexico. And he's literally like done everything in the company except be legal counsel and probably not CFO because they probably have had certified accountants, but literally has done all of that. Mm. And yet, the way it has been for years, if he just decided, hey, you know what, I want to get a business degree, he would show up and someone would say, here are the list of all the entry-level courses you need to take. Right. And the reality is he could probably run the department.
He could run.
Right.
Exactly.
Because he's done marketing and operations and logistics and transportation, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So this is a way of quantifying those work capabilities, various training. And up until just about a month and a half ago, only 8 states in the nation had essentially a strategic plan and framework to leverage credit for prior learning for adult learners, you know, going back to or continuing their education. Now Indiana is the 9th. Our team spent the better part of a year with our friends in the academia and employers and others forming this really great strategic plan and framework. And so we'll be, you know, pushing that out and implementing it with our partners in higher ed. And the long and the short of it is it helps an adult learner, you know, accelerate their end goal of that, you know, credential, that degree, and also in the process, obviously saving time, saving money, you know, quantifying their capabilities. So then they're that much more marketable in the workforce.
Now, Commissioner, I want to spend some time speaking about the Indiana pre-admission strategy. I'm so excited to talk about this because I understand that this new initiative will have a profound and proactive approach to college enrollment in the Hoosier State, beginning with the inaugural class of 2024. So can you spend some time just kind of unpacking what that is?
Hitting some of my favorite topics today, Dee. This all ties back to that enrollment goal we were talking about, right? We had seen such a precipitous decline. Other states had. Ours was just steeper than, well, any of us would like. So we started thinking about proven solutions and challenges that might exist for enrollment. And literally talking as a team one day, I know I made kind of a glib comment, but it really was how I felt, that you know, the broader marketplace for the consumer of higher education is challenging. You know, if you think about it, here you're likely to spend, whether of your own funds or, you know, grant and scholarship funds, et cetera, you're likely to spend tens or maybe hundreds of thousands of dollars. And you've got a few institutions in mind because, well, those are the ones you know about.
Right.
And so you don't know about all the other institutions that might be applicable. And then you go through this process of applying and all the stuff that goes with that, and then you wait. You literally wait to see, will they actually take me, and just to be blunt about it, my money,
right,
to do what I want to do.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And so we're having this conversation, and you know, we all agreed, you know, the marketplace just isn't really as consumer friendly as it could be. Well, we started digging into it and said, how could we make it better? And as we were forming our ideas, we found out that the state of Idaho was doing something basically like what I'll explain in a second is our pre-admission strategy. We were the third in the nation to do this. Idaho, and I think Minnesota was second. Now we're the third, and others, by the way, others starting to follow us. essentially, what we've done is go to all the public and private institutions, and we did so very quickly for this year's cohort of students. We actually thought about launching this in August of 24, and my response to our team was, no, let's run. Let's don't look for perfect this year. Let's get as close as we can, but let's run. Mm-hmm. So we went to our public and privates and said, hey, you tell us, give us a threshold GPA and or SAT that would, you know, constitute admissions to your, you know, to your institution. And then we were able to work with the Department of Education and local schools to say, hey, now we need that data. Basically, all juniors in high school take the SAT. So got the scores right there.
The scores.
And now this coming year, we'll actually have all the GPAs because it's been, you know, put on an electronic platform.
Okay.
We actually went to all the high schools last year in a very, very short notice. And long story short, we captured about 80% of all of the higher ed institutions in Indiana and about 75% or 80% of the kids.
Wow.
Well, at this point, and of course, I'm not the, you know, tech genius at all. That's fortunately, we have really smart people who do that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's a matter of matching up the data, right? And so in September, we started sending for the very first time in Indiana letters to the homes, electronic communication and letters to the homes of every single, you know, of these high school students. Now, again, it was about 80% of them this year, around 57,000. This fall, this September, we'll send it to all seniors, and that's around 75,000. But the letter is pretty simple. You know, it said, hey, you know, it was congratulating them. And then it provided a list of every single public and private institution, and again, about 80% participated with us, to which you would be pre-admitted. And I got to tell you, I had no idea sort of what the reaction would be. And I pretty quickly found out, I was sitting in a meeting, I think the first time something came through, and I don't know how to put it, my phone started to blow up. Text messages, calls, emails from people I didn't even know.
Wow.
Saying, this is amazing. The average student found out that she or he would be pre-admitted to 24 institutions in Indiana, schools they'd never heard of. You know, so I think about up here, you know, folks I'm going to be visiting with today, you know, that say a kid in southern Indiana suddenly learned about Purdue Northwest, or they learned about Calumet College, or right? You know, they learned that these other places are there, and, you know, by gosh, they would be admitted.
Right.
As many as 38, there were as many as 38 that participated, counting all the regionals. And, you know, there were some students who actually found out 38. And just to find out then from parents and then some of the kids, I mean, I have people coming up all the time and saying, hey, the most recent one was one who said, hey, my kid was going to go to this school in Ohio. He's not going there now.
Right.
And told me the three that he had narrowed it down to right here in Indiana. So, right, it's keeping the talent here, making education more accessible, and then through 21st Century and our other grants and things, also making it more affordable.
Now, Commissioner, I want to shift for a moment and talk about the 2024 Indiana legislative session in regards to higher education. Are there any notes that you would like to share regarding the session in regards to higher education?
I would. And building off of some of those priorities, and again, thanks for mentioning, you know, some of those key goals in the HOPE agenda. But building off of some of those, we received, again, really broad support. There was one primary bill that contained four different things in it that the way I've been looking at it, you know, our ultimate goal is to improve educational attainment, you know, post the high school diploma, whatever training and education that might look like, because, again, economically and socially, the outcomes are just better. But you know, so improve the attainment for individuals. But in the process, our primary focus this year was on access and affordability. So building on things like the pre-admissions, 21st Century Scholar, the expansion we did of the 21st or of the Frank O'Bannon grant for low-income students and, you know, those various things. So four components to it. The first was to look at our Indiana College Corps. I'll make that really quick. But the Indiana College Corps has been around about 12 years, and it's a block of 30 credit hours of dual credit that high school students can take. You know, and it came about because a lot of times what happens is students kind of collect what we think of as random acts of dual credit. And they're learning, obviously, and it's good that they're learning and so forth. But it's even more important to know that those can fully transfer to a college or university. And so this was created about 12 years ago. As a sidebar, when I came into the role about 2 years ago, I was stunned to find out that only about 84 of our high schools out of more than 500 in Indiana actually offered the full core. They would offer a lot of dual credit, but you know, getting it down to that. And the reason that's so important is, by law, that the public institutions have to fully accept that block of 30 hours. Well, that's a whole year's worth of college. And now many of our privates accept it because, well, it makes sense, right? The marketplace is working. And we put an immediate emphasis on that. And I challenged our team to move it up as quickly as possible toward at least 500. Well, that was April 2022. By August, now taking 10 years to get to 84, by August, we were up at 149.
Wow.
By this past August, we were up to 222. And by this coming August, we expect to be up around 300. Well, this bill takes it one step further, and it requires all high schools to either offer it or to report back to the commission on what the barriers are and what their plan of implementation would be. So it's such a gift to young people that if they can leave high school with this full year, they're more likely to enroll. They're much more likely to complete. And of course, I'm crossing my fingers. I hope they stay in Indiana then when they do.
No brain drain, right.
Yeah. So that was the first component. The second component is really interesting. It's called reverse transfer. I'll give you an example. Let's use Ivy Tech locally. If someone is pursuing, say, their associate degree, and then they transfer to, say, Purdue Northwest, but they don't finish their associate degree, say they've taken 45 hours out of 60 hours, they go ahead and transfer because they want to, and that's the next best step for them. However, when they are at, say, Purdue Northwest, and Purdue Northwest has just been such a great partner, maybe I'll say another four institution, if they complete the hours there that they would have at Ivy Tech, right, they would have what would on paper constitute an associate degree. So this puts in place a mechanism to do that reverse transfer. So for the four-year institution to essentially reverse those hours back to the two-year college so that student can get an associate degree. You know, sometimes people ask, so why is that important? Well, the fact of the matter is, even when someone, you know, transfers to that next level and says, hey, I'm going to go ahead and transfer even though I haven't completed this associate degree, many times they still don't complete and don't get their bachelor's degree.
Makes sense.
Right?
Makes
so sense. In this mm-hmm. instance, rather than transferring, not getting the bachelor's degree and not having anything, they have that associate degree. So again, it's just so logical. And this puts a mechanism in place for us just to broadly do that. The third element is really, really interesting. We've got, you know, frankly, we've had national media calling us saying, hey, what are you doing with this? It's called degree in three. Purdue has done some of this. Ball State has. Others have, but right, it hasn't been a state priority. And what this does is it requires our state public institutions to look at their various programs and determine what degrees could possibly be done in 3 years rather than four.
That's a game changer.
Right? That's yeah. You reduce changer. The time, you reduce the money, you get into the marketplace sooner. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, every institution is going to report back and say, hey, here's how we're going to do it. Here are the ones we're going to do. And of course, we hope that you know, sort of the velocity increases and we'll be tracking it very closely that more and more will offer that. Mm-hmm. Wouldn't be a requirement for a student to do it in 3 years, but mm-hmm. rather an option that is very clearly defined of how to go do that. Mm-hmm. And then the fourth one is very similar to sort of that reverse transfer that I was describing in this context. We know that in spite of Indiana's completion rate, so going to and finishing college, while it's really been improving over the years, we're 11th best in the nation now. I'm pleased with that. Of course, I want us to be a top 10. But even while it's been improving broadly, a lot of students still don't complete. And you know, and that's just a shame. If they started a four-year institution, you know, maybe get three-quarters of it done, and life gets in the way, right? A family member is sick. That individual gets sick. A host of things we know are real life barriers. What this allows us to do is to work with the four-year institutions. We'll do a study to see what the advisability and feasibility would be for those four-year institutions to offer an associate degree. So it and where it would mostly apply is, you know, the student who says, again, hey, I'm going to go for my bachelor's of science, life gets in the way, you know, they can't get back, mm-hmm. but yet they've done enough credits, 60 hours, mm-hmm. you know, to constitute an associate degree. And rather than them just leaving, you know, maybe with debt, no credential, mm-hmm. this challenges all of us to say, would it be advisable and really study this to look at that side of the equation? Sort of another bill, it wasn't exactly a companion bill, also does the opposite, not really the opposite, but also complements it. And that has us, along with our two-year institutions, especially Ivy Tech, to look at and say, you know, what's the advisability and feasibility of them offering certain four-year degrees? And especially in those applied science areas, like some of the things in manufacturing or nursing where there's such an incredible high demand. So those last two, you know, we don't know what the outcome of that'll be, but it's the first time we've really made a pointed and concerted effort to look at it and say, you know, how could this possibly help students?
In the few minutes or so that we have left, I understand that the Indiana Commission on Higher Education has gone through a bit of restructuring and reorganization. Can you share with our listening audience what that is?
Yes, I would love to. And sort of this is, you know, sort of the backside of it. A couple of different things. As we launched this vision last year, we started following it immediately by what we refer to as a strategic management plan. So like, how do we go make this stuff happen? Honestly, I think too oftentimes in government and other places, big ideas are out there, but executing them, that's where things fall short. So we created this strategic management plan. It comes from industry and from private business, been developed by, you know, really world-renowned consultants, and we've adopted it. And it goes from our vision, the things you were talking about, to then the strategic goals in the HOPE agenda. Each one of those assigned to two senior associate commissioners, and then each initiative, and we talked about just a few here, go out to people within the organization. Ultimately, what we've done, and this has just been in this year, is each person, and we have a little over 60 people on our entire team across the state, each person now has at least three measurable goals for the year that relate back to one of those Hope Agenda goals. And, you know, part of it, yes, is about accountability, but also I've had the privilege of managing and leading people for a long time. It helps show people why they're there, that regardless of what they're doing, how it fits to the big goal, you know, and it feeds that passion. We've also realigned. We had a research team, really, you know, great work, but it often resulted in reports that were, you know, sort of stale data, and they, you know, mostly sat on a shelf. We reorganized that. We now have a business intelligence team, and we've moved from reports. You'll be seeing later this year an online, real-time updated dashboard for any Hoosier to access. I just don't want people who are, you know, mildly, you know, or who maybe have deep interest in this to get to this data and information. I want any Hoosier who wants to see it to see it, and maybe businesses and others who want to move to our state. So that is going to be coming online, and we're going to keep, because we need to, using some of the lagging data, because, you know, some of it comes out only like every, you know, it's like 2 years old when you get it. And that's very frustrating to me. So we're adding in things like leading indicators. You know, the college going rate is always a 2-year lag data, and that just makes me crazy. So that's why we're using the enrollment now too. By the way, I should mention this, first time in 13 years, enrollment was up this school year for colleges and universities in Indiana. 13 years. So awesome. We're pleased with that.
Yes.
And then we're beginning to forecast on all of these initiatives. So our fellow Hoosiers for whom we work will know, are these things working? Where are we on track? Where are we off track? And then the last thing is, I just have to tell you this. We started about a year ago implementing something we call the Partnership Pentagon. We went to leaders in 5 areas of our broad society and said, we want your help. We want you to push us, pull us, tell us to move faster, tell us what we ought to be looking at. And so they're from 5 areas: government, education, business, nonprofit organizations, and specifically some I've mentioned today, community and faith-based organizations, and then philanthropy. Each of those areas is just, they're just so fundamental to civil society. And even beyond that, you know, I am absolutely convinced when each one of those 5 is working in concert, you know, it's not a total of 5 at the end. It's something much, much more, right? It's you know, it's something that's much more exponential when they come together. And we've been seeing that. They've been advising us. They're going to issue a report this summer of how to build on the Hope Agenda. And so we're eager for that. And then we're also doing a consumer study, the deepest one that's ever been done regarding higher ed on consumers here in Indiana. We'll also issue that this summer.
That is so exciting. You know, I could spend an additional hour speaking to you because, again, there's so much information to be shared from your office. And so I'm so excited that you stopped by our studio. And I know that this will be probably the first of many conversations that we will have about all of the exciting news coming from your commission. So I thank you for swinging by Lakeshore Public Media Studios, and I look forward to having you again.
Dee, and I can't thank you enough. And I, too, hope this is only the first of our conversations.
You're listening to Regionally Speaking on listener-supported Lakeshore Public Media. Lakeshore Public Media's CEO, Chuck Roberts, as well as Carl Keurig, joins us now to discuss NWI Volunteer Hub. Here's the conversation. I am just so excited to have you two in studio with me to talk about the new initiative that was recently kicked off. Lakeshore Public Media is excited to unveil the new NWI Volunteer Hub, which is a comprehensive digital volunteer program that any nonprofit, civic, faith, or health-related organization, a government municipality, or a business here in the region can use, and I should add, at no cost, thanks to support from our amazing community foundation partners. So Chuck, tell our listening audience more about this new online platform.
So I've gone to many community meetings, and I heard a lot from a lot of different organizations that there is diminishing numbers of folks that are volunteering. And I asked them specifically, where are they asking for volunteers? And they said on their individual web pages. And I saw right away that the issue was, if people aren't going to the web pages directly, then they don't know that the organization needs volunteers. So I came back to the station and told Carl, we need to do something about this. We need to fill in the hole. And my idea was to create a simple page that had like Excel spreadsheets with information that you'd go see the information, get the phone number, and go to it. And Carl, being the ingenuitive person that he is, said, Chuck, we can make it better than that. We can invest in software and create a page that's interactive and an environment that helps deliver volunteers to where they need to be. So we came up with this volunteernwi.org platform that allows people organizations that need donors to post their organization, what their needs are, how many folks they need them, where in Northwest Indiana this volunteering is supposed to happen. And then people who are looking to volunteer can just log onto the site, type in either the type of organization they'd like to be with or the area in which they'd like to volunteer, and that's populated on this site. There's also a calendar, so the organizations that are involved can post events that are going on, and it kind of helps planning, because if you see an event already there, an organization might not schedule at the same time, which helps out. But there's also going to be tools in there to be able to track the number of hours a volunteer does, which correlates to money for the organizations. But speaking of money, because of the support that we're going to get for this site, it's going to be free to vendors who post information on it, as well as free for people to come and find volunteerism.
The Lakeshore Public Media is a nonprofit organization, and I want to be clear. Is this a digital platform that was developed specifically for nonprofit organizations to use, or can any organization utilize the new NWI Volunteer Hub?
Yeah, absolutely. It's not limited to nonprofit organizations. We've actually had discussions with Mayor Milton and Gary on how his administration can use this to organize their community volunteers who are doing some amazing work in the city there. And we understand that it might not be a registered nonprofit, or it might be a small community group of volunteers who get together and do park cleanups. It could be, you know, a wide range of things. And so we didn't limit it to just nonprofits. And that's why, you know, again, you don't need to have a tax identification number to put in there to get, you know, your opportunities up. Lakeshore will monitor it to make sure that, you know, that all the organizations on there are legit. And if we have any questions, we'll reach out. But for the most part, we wanted this to just be anybody, any organization, any community that needs volunteers in order to become, you know, in order to have success in what they're trying to accomplish, can use this tool.
I think that's awesome that you said, and Chuck, you can chime in. I think it's awesome that you added that it's not just a nonprofit organization, but just thinking about all of the government entities that are out here that need volunteers, especially you mentioned Gary, they are working on blight in that community. But a city like Gary, being able to utilize this to mobilize volunteers, I think is so awesome.
And there's going to be a calendar, a community event calendar on the site as well. So nonprofits, small businesses, municipal entities that have an event that they want to promote, it can be on that calendar where it's a one stop where people come in to find out what's going on in the area. We just want to be a resource to help shed a light on all the other resources that already exist in Northwest Indiana. And we want to do so through this volunteer hub. Once again, at volunteernwi.org.
Chuck, again, the NWI Volunteer Hub officially launched several weeks ago. And when you and Carl are out in the community at community events, meetings, engagement opportunities, you're serving as ambassadors or evangelists, if you will, sharing the good news about this new digital platform. I want to go back for a moment, though. Why did Lakeshore Public Media take the lead on this initiative? And to that point, what has the response been who are using this platform to connect volunteer opportunities?
It's an example of Lakeshore filling a hole that was needed. We went to the volunteer festival there in Crown Point, and once we mentioned just a couple times that we were going to start this hub, people were just, there was a buzz and people were coming to the table. How do I get on? How do I put my needs on there? One gentleman said, I need large men to lift heavy things. And I thought, well, you can put that on your profile and let that be known that that's what you need is someone to do some heavy lifting for you. But it's all about also the resource that Carl talked about. It's bookkeeping. It helps you keep track of your volunteers and what they're doing for the organization. Helps you monetize what it is that's being done. A lot of the nonprofits reached out to us and told us without volunteers, they would have to raise hundreds of thousands of extra dollars just to stay alive.
Wow.
So it's not just about a quality of life and helping people, but that's a main part of it. But it's about keeping the organizations alive and living. And we saw that need and we decided to create volunteernwi.org to help with that.
Carl, I want to turn to you for a moment specifically because it's your team that heads up the technical aspect of this new digital platform, right? So we live in a day and age where many people are concerned about their cybersecurity. And not only individuals, but organizations as well. And so someone may be listening in and they may want to ask this question. Is this new site safe and how will it be monitored?
Oh, first of all, there's not a lot of personal or private information. Like I said, from an organization standpoint, you don't even have to put in your tax identification number or anything like that. And as an individual, it's pretty much just your location, so that this way you can sort opportunities, your first and last name, and then really just the type of interest you want. So an email, phone number, so that you can be notified. So there's not a lot of sensitive information on it, but obviously it lives. That's why we have it kind of hosted on our website. This way it gets the same securities and protection that our website has, and we definitely want to encourage people to, you know, not worry about the information that they put on there, because we're not sharing it with anybody either. It's really just the information that's needed to keep that communication flowing between the organizations who need volunteers and the individuals who want to volunteer. And so there's not a lot of worry there.
Yeah, if any other site is asking for your social security number to volunteer, don't do it. Go to volunteernwi.org and sign up there, or find the organization that you'd like to volunteer for at that site.
Again, to learn more about the NWI Volunteer Hub and to create a profile as an individual or an organization, visit www.volunteernwi.org. For more information on how to support Lakeshore Public Media's Volunteer Hub initiative, please email sponsorship@lakeshorepublicmedia.org. You're listening to Regionally Speaking on listener-supported Lakeshore Public Media. With a look at the November 2024 local, statewide, and national economies, we turn now to Ersheng Leung, an economist with the PNC Financial Services Group. Ersheng, as always, thank you for joining us on Regionally Speaking.
Thank you, Dee. Thanks for having me again.
Absolutely, absolutely. So as always, you join us to give us an economic outlook statewide, locally, as well nationally. So again, I'm always glad to have you with us on Regionally Speaking. I want to start with this. What are some economic updates out there? What do they mean, and what do those updates mean for Hoosiers?
Okay, so we actually got this fresh jobs report from October. You know, this is indeed a weak jobs report. About 12,000 jobs added on the month, and that is the weakest month for the labor market since December 2020. But I want to point out that it is very difficult to tell much of anything about the labor market from this jobs report due to some large distortions there, you know, from the Hurricane Helene, Hurricane Milton, as well as the Boeing strike. You know, by looking at the details, you're seeing private goods and producing industry lost 37,000 jobs in October. That includes job losses of 46,000 in manufacturing. Well, that mostly was due to the Boeing strike. And private services providing industry added just 9,000 jobs over the month, including big losses of, you know, around 48,000 jobs in temporary health services. Well, these losses are likely due to, you know, the hurricanes and to some extent the Boeing strike. So it is difficult to tell much, you know, anything about the labor market, you know, the economic fundamental from the just this jobs report, you know. But we also can take a look at the household survey. You know, the unemployment rate was generated from the household survey. It was unchanged at 4.1% in October, despite the storms and the strike. You know, we're seeing employment in the survey of households falling over the months. That's actually the first drop in this measure since May this year. But look, employment tends to be more volatile in the household measure relative to the employer measure. But while employment was dropping, the labor force also fell by 220,000. That leaves the unemployment rate unchanged. To explain reason why we're seeing, you know, large drops in the payroll survey while the unemployment rate was unchanged at 4.1% in October. But outside the storms and the Boeing, the evidence indicates that labor market is still in solid shape, you know, although not quite as strong as it was in last year. Job growth in the first 9 months of this year averaged about 190,000 a month. That is indeed down from 250,000 per month last year. But this is still somewhat above what the economy can support over the long run. And unemployment rate has increased somewhat this year. You know, it was 3.4%, the lowest for a couple of months last year. But at 4.1% in October right now is really not bad, and it's still consistently below the rate that the Federal Reserve views as consistent with the maximum employment.
You just said something. You said this is more than what our economy can handle long term. So I have to ask you, does that mean that we're going to have a recession given the turmoil in August? What are some of PNC's expectations on inflation and the economy?
Okay, that is a great question. So right now, our baseline still calls moderate growth. And in fact, we anticipate and we expect some slowing in the labor market. As you know, some of the inflation in the economy was indeed driven by some of the very hot wage growth. You know, for example, prices were rising very fast the last year and indeed has been slowing this year to about very close to the Fed's 2% inflation objective at 2.1% in September. That was down from 2.3% in August. Actually, the slowest year-over-year pace in inflation since February 2021. So really, we were anticipating some of the softness in the labor market, and that is necessary to bring down some of the hot inflation there that the Federal Reserve tries to control. So in terms of, you know, what people feel about prices, what Hoosiers feel about prices, I can tell you that they are seeing definitely some cooling in energy price. Oil prices were down from last year, but they are still elevated somewhat above, you know, the pre-pandemic prices. We're not seeing prices returning to where they were before the pandemic, but good news is that the pace of the rise in the overall price level continue to slow. And outside energy prices, I mean, household income continued to rise in September. So that is a good news for households in Indiana as well. You know, that continued to support some of the spending, despite people are seeing prices are still increasing, especially food prices. We're seeing food price continue to increase at a faster pace in September. But overall, the labor market remains steady, sturdy, and job growth. We have good job and wage gains. Consumer spending can continue to increase at a steady pace. So yeah, we do think that we're not forecasting any recession despite this weak job report. But like I said, it is very difficult to tell much of anything about the labor market, the economic fundamental, from just this October jobs report.
Now, before I let you go, I have to ask you. So the Federal Open Market Committee meets in 2 weeks. What do you think they'll do about interest rates? And what are the implications for the economy as a whole?
So we are anticipating 2 more interest rate cuts by the end of this year. So the Federal Open Market Committee will probably cut back interest rate by 25 basis points in the next week. And we talk about this, that the Federal Reserve has a dual mandate of, you know, maximum employment price stability. And we have seen inflation slowing this year significantly to about at close to the Fed's 2% objective. And right now, the concern has turned into about the labor market. You know, we're seeing continued softening in the labor market, and people are concerned whether the economy is heading into a recession. And we think that with this continued softening in the labor market, the likely outcome is that the Fed will cut back 25 basis points in the next week. Some of the evidence for the labor market, like weekly initial claims, that can be volatile. But if you look at some of the trend, the four-week moving average there ending October 26th, that is up sharply from same week last year, that is indeed suggesting the U.S. labor market has cooled over the past year. You know, job gains has slowed to an average about 2,000 this year from about 250,000 last year. Unemployment rate has increased. Well, all these signals, all the initial claims numbers, job gains has slowed, unemployment rate has increased from last year. All these evidence points that the U.S. labor market indeed was cooling off this year in 2024. And we expect the continued softening in the labor market will go on, as, you know, some of the monetary policy is still restrictive and from, you know, especially several years ago. And rates are still elevated despite, you know, we had the big cut of 50 basis point in September. So the dot plot released in the last FOMC also point that the Fed will likely have 2 additional rate cuts by the end of this year. So that actually coincides with PNC's forecast.
Ershong, as always, we enjoy having you join us on Regionally Speaking because you have the ability to help us understand an economic outlook locally, statewide, and nationally. And so we're so glad you were with us today to help us break down, again, as you said, all of the signals continuing towards a soft market, but just helping us to understand or at least get a peek into the interest rates still being high as many of us continue to go out to purchase automobiles and homes and that nature. So again, we thank you for joining us on Regionally Speaking. And we can't wait to have you back with us next month.
Yeah, thanks for having me again. It's always my pleasure. Always my pleasure, Dee.
For more information about PNC Financial Services Group, visit www.pnc.com.
And that's it for Regionally Speaking for this week. Thanks to our guests from the Indiana Commission on Higher Education, Chris Lowry, from Lakeshore Public Media, Chuck Roberts and Carl Keurig, and from PNC Financial Services Group, Ershong Leong. And we'll be back with you next week with an all-new show.